everybody have a book?
Does anyone need a book? Y'all get, you got one. Okay.
All right, good.
That's a good place to begin, knowing that we have a book and we're all operating from the same owner's manual, so to speak. Happy that you're here. Good to see you tonight. We are looking at this book, The Eternal Kingdom, by Brother Maddox and McCray. And we have been studying last week, as a matter of fact, with regards to discussing a departure from the doctrine that has been delivered that we see in the Scriptures. We were discussing two main issues: original sin and infant baptism. Those were the two things that we were discussing last week. And just as a review, Tertullian was the first to introduce this doctrine of original sin. And this is where everyone shares in Adam's guilt and is accountable for Adam's sin. And you remember we spent a little time last week looking in Romans chapter 5. And when closely looking at the text that Paul delivered to those saints in that particular passage, we truly do see with regards to sin, we're accountable for our own sin. Okay, yeah, sin entered into the world through Adam, but I'm not responsible for his sin, no more than Adam's responsible for my sin. But that's we looked at that last week. Then we began to look at infant baptism, because the target, remember, seems to always be moving. And boy, did we look at the target move last week. We went everything with regards to Cyprian of Carthage was the first bishop to approve of infant baptism. But look at this. But he did not what?
Require it.
He didn't require it. He did not insist on it. It was just basically, this is my feeling, this is my opinion. And you know, in the parentheses, this is an example of how opinion becomes doctrine. And it is today. Okay? Someone had an opinion on something, and others had that like-minded opinion, and all of a sudden, a man's opinion became doctrine. But that's not where it stops. Some church leaders believed in age appropriation, such as Gregory of Nazianzus. What was an appropriate age in his mind for a child to be baptized? 3, all right? Remember last week we were discussing this? Why not 4? Or 5? Okay? Why would you grab the number 3 and cling on to it? 7's a perfect number. Why not just grab 7? You know, so again, here's that target. It just moved a little bit. Okay? So others believe in the doctrine of baptismal regeneration, where one is baptized for forgiveness of sins, okay, apart from faith and repentance. That's interesting. Okay? So, now the target's... Did you catch that? The target just moved a little bit. All right? We're not going to require faith and repentance. Well, then who can be included then all of a sudden in that baptism? Children, right? All right? Children. All right? So, you see how we're catering to the infant baptism thing. Well, you don't need to have faith, and you don't need to repent, but we are going to insist on baptism. But here's the thing about it. What happens after you're baptized? Because they did not teach or emphasize rebaptism. As a matter of fact, the attitude with regenerational baptism was that, man, if you sin after you're baptized, I don't know if there's any hope for you. And that leads to the target's moving again. That leads to the reason why some individuals, remember last week, we had discussed, well, if that's the case, I might as well just wait till the 11th hour and be baptized. I mean, you know, I don't want to sin after my baptism. So, like Constantine, the emperor of Rome, I'll just wait. I'll put it off to the 11th hour, which he was never immersed, by the way. Okay? By the time we're looking at 3rd century, definitely by the 5th century, 600 years after the 1st century church was established, infant baptism was something that was common, okay? But as we're looking at this. So people are saying, well, wait a minute. Let's just wait. Let's just wait as long as we can. And then, you know, I'll do it then, because I don't want to take any risk of sinning after my baptism. Dan, you had a comment or a question.
That's a question. If because of these issues with baptism and what people assume they were, what baptism was for, is that why we have denominations today that believe baptism is just to become a member of whatever congregation you're joining and it's not the center of the salvation?
It's, again, the target's moved so much, okay? It's symbolic, okay? You have a discussion with some religious groups, and you can help me out here, Carl, if you want, but you have a discussion with some religious bodies, some religious groups. It's just symbolic. It's not out of necessity. Now, what I think is interesting is that we can look at something like doctrinal, or this doctrine with regards to baptismal regeneration. They actually did believe baptism washed away your sins. Those folks are more close to the cross on that subject than the ones who just say it's just a symbol. Seriously, think about it. But it still misses the mark. It still misses the mark. Okay, comments or questions up to this point? But you see how this target, I mean, it's always moving. We have gone from, well, you've got to baptize babies because they inherit Adam's sin, to the point, wait a minute, let's wait to the very last minute. Because once we're baptized, you know, I can't sin thereafter. Okay? And such things as, you know, forgiveness of sins beyond baptism just seems unrealistic in some people's minds. To the point where, let's see if we can have a happy medium. Hey, maybe we can baptize kids when they're 3 years old. You see, I mean, it's crazy. It's just all over the place. So these were the things we looked at. Infant baptism became a general practice in the 5th century. Okay, it's something that became common in the 5th century. You began to see it more and more. All right, so that was basically our review from what we looked at. We're going to continue to look at this on page 120 in your books, which will require a little reading here. Let's look at this, where it says, throughout all this early period, let's have someone to read just two paragraphs there on page 120. Who wants to start there and begin reading that? Throughout all this early period. Who's got it? Sharon. Sorry. You were volunteering, Sharon. Sorry. Go ahead, Sharon. And she volunteered herself. I see. Okay, let's stop there for a moment. With regards to what was there an agreement on between the apostolic fathers and the apologist? What was there an agreement on? What does it tell us? That baptism was indeed necessary for their forgiveness of sins. Okay, there was an agreement on that. And again, I hearken back to a comment that I made a long time ago with regards to, this gives you a leg up when you're studying scriptures with folks. No church history. When you have discussions with individuals from various religious groups, denominations, and they're today in their modern version of the way they are practicing things, and you go back and research their history, I guarantee most don't even know their history. Okay? They don't know their history. If they knew their history, they'd be shocked to know that individuals like Martin Luther and various others didn't even approve of instrumental music. And if you were to share that with them, they'd be like, what? And it's true, you know? So this is why it's important for us to know a lot of this departure, when it happened, how it happened. And this is something that we're looking at with regards to the apostolic fathers. The apologists, remember the apologists. They're not apologizing because they're Christians, right? They're, you know, why were they apologists? What is
they're
an apologist?
Defending
their faith, okay? That's exactly what they're doing. A lot of them wrote letters to the emperors, governors, defending their faith, okay? That's what they were doing. About when did baptism become a ritualistic ceremony? Is that something that we looked at? I don't know if we made it that far or not. What? Yeah, okay, right. So, you know, about the third century, something that, and you see this, you know, when we're talking about a ritualistic ceremony, what comes to your mind when you think of that? It's just a ritualistic ceremony. What image do you capture? What comes to your mind when you're just thinking about it? It's a ritualistic ceremony. Dale.
People dressing up fancy and, you know, putting on a show more or less of anything.
It's production, right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Where would that come from? You know, in this paragraph that we looked at, in the middle paragraph, you know, why would that be? You know, there's a statement that is made here by our author. I think is very telling. Who are they trying to keep up with? The world, right? The world, right? You know, Carl in his lesson tonight was talking about the world. We're in the world, but we're not of the world, right? This last sentence, guys, the desire to be like the nations round about has always been a curse to God's people. Does 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 19 and 20 shout out at you? Someone go back and read that.
We want a king.
We want a king. That's basically it, right? We want a king. We want a king.
That's what the song
is. Yeah, we want to be like the other nations.
Yes.
Okay, that's
God's
people.
We want to be like everybody else. We want a king.
Everybody else. And there's a temptation within the church as today to be like everybody else, okay? To be like everybody else. Dale.
Well, a lot of them too. My Christian church, when they split off the church, they wanted to do some things to attract people. Well, we need to get more people in. So, and the church started to do this too. Move away. Well, we'll entertain the kids, and we'll have basketball leagues or something, and we'll have a special thing for them, and trying to accommodate the kids what they wanted to get them into the building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, that's what the world does, so why can't we do that and get the numbers in?
Right. And you know, this is what we're seeing in church history with regards to, we're looking at the cults, we're looking at the mystery religions that existed at this particular time. A lot of things were a big production. We've discussed this early on in our study with regards to the mystery religions and how they tried to pander to the government, actually to emperors. And when they would have celebrations, and they would honor their gods. It was a big production, okay? And a lot of them, here's the hypocrisy of it, a lot of them despised the Roman government, but they would still yet, in honoring, you know, their god, they would find a way to honor the emperor as well. I've always felt that was, you know, interesting. Dale.
Well, even today, look at, you go into a denomination or something and look at the people up front. They have special robes on, and they're noticeably different from everybody else, and there's so much pomp and circumstance.
Right.
It's a show to put on, and people like things like that.
Right. Let's read this last little bit here, guys. The meetings of the church. Let's read, someone just read that paragraph real quick. The meetings of the church. Who's got it? Roger.
Okay. The meetings of the church during this period varied in accordance with the circumstances. During persecution, meetings were held after dark or early in the morning before daylight. At first, the Jewish Christians continued to keep the Sabbath, or the seventh day. They also Sabbath observance, if this continued and the first day of the week was kept as the Lord's Day. In answer to the opinion that Constantine changed the day of worship from Saturday to Sunday, it should be observed that the writing of Justin referred to earlier says clearly that the early Christians observed the first day of the week as a general practice 150 years before Constantine. The Lord's Supper was a regular part of the Lord's Day worship. At times, the congregation shared a meal together just before partaking of the bread and the wine in memory of Christ. The wine often was mixed with water, not for ceremonially, but to dilute its strength.
Okay, let's go ahead and stop there. When we're talking about this remark here, Constantine changed the day of worship from Saturday to Sunday. Now, again, you're reading strictly with regards to church history, and depending on who you're reading, you may say, oh, Constantine gets credit for that. Does Constantine get credit for the fact that the Lord's Day is the Lord's Day on Sunday? No. You know, the Lord gets credit for that, right? But this is why we look at this, okay? Because someone who doesn't understand the scriptures, doesn't understand the Bible, and they're just reading from a secular viewpoint, they will say, well, Constantine started that. I've heard people, believe it or not, in discussing history, they give Constantine credit for it, okay? And that's not accurate, okay? And you need to be able to take them to the scriptures and show them the Lord's Day and how significant the first day of the week is, okay? So, you know, again, that's something to keep in mind. As the influence of pagan religions began to affect the church, the Lord's Supper became a ceremony of pomp and ritualism. Gold and silver vessels came into use. And as in the cult mysteries, all who were not members were excluded from the service. As time passed, the elements took on superstitious nature and became the medicine of immortality, of immorality. As the elements took on magical powers, they began to be administered just before the death to remove sin. With the growing idea that ministers were priests, we see how the simple memorial service of the New Testament became became the mass in medieval Catholicism. Not all groups agreed in the changes that came about. The ascetic began to doubt that wine should be used. Temptation became so adverse to its use under the circumstances that he substituted water for the Lord's Supper. He just flat out just started using water. So when we're looking at this last question here, what outside forces influenced the church with regards to unscriptural views of acts like baptism, Lord's Supper, and what have you? And we begin to see again with regards to the mystery religions, cults, and what have you. They begin to influence the church, okay? So that's something to keep in mind. All right, any questions or comments over that section before we move on to another one? Any thoughts? All right, let's go on and discuss the departure in manner of life, asceticism, and celibacy.
Scott, can I just ask you one thing about the Lord's Supper? The denominational world today, in many cases, they don't observe it but like once a quarter.
Correct.
And I don't know, in the passages we've read so far, or the chapters we've read so far, I don't remember that being discussed. I assume that's coming later, but I think the Catholics practice it every week, and maybe several times a week. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of event going on, so they will.
Good point. Dale was going to make a remark. Go ahead, Dale. You have a.
You'll notice now that we're starting to get in more Catholicism.
Yes.
Coming into this. Picture,
it's apparent, isn't it?
Creating things and gaining power.
Yes.
So keep that in mind. By the second century, it really took off.
Okay, so that's a great question. How did we go from, we see the first century church observing the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, okay? Comes around every week. Then we go from this, as Dale was saying, this Catholic influence. We're beginning to see remnants of Catholicism in rearing its head, okay? Then all of a sudden we see a departure from the Lord's Supper. Some people just hit and miss. You know, we'll observe it a couple times out of the year, okay? That's a good question, Carl. I'll tell you a discussion that I had with somebody. I'll even get personal here with my dad, okay? My dad's not a member of the church, okay? And they observe the Lord's Supper maybe once or twice out of the year, okay? Now, it's not a Catholic church. It's a It's a Holy Roller church down in southern Ohio. You know, I'm glad Joe Burrow didn't mention that in his Heisman speech. But but anyway, that's my country, y'all. I saw him play in high school, as a matter of fact, at Athens. And Jackson beat him. I just got to go on record for saying that. But anyway, you know, but my dad's remark was basically this. You know, whenever we're looking at, as off as you do this in remembrance of me. Well, his comment was, and you need to know this because people are, this is what they say, all right? Well, often could be just any time, you know? As often as you do this, it could just be any time. Often is any time.
And that would be fine if we didn't have other instructions.
And that was my remark. I said, well, here's what often means. Often is as often as you meet on the first day of the week, every week. Mm-hmm. That's the often, right? And you're right. That's the blueprint. Dale, go ahead.
You know, there was a movement, too, where, well, we didn't want it to become commonplace. This was a special thing now, and if we do it every week, then it's going to be commonplace, and nobody's going to think.
It will have no effect.
Yeah.
It'll have no effect.
Right. That's an argument you'll come across.
Yes, go ahead.
I've had somebody tell me that one time, and I said, but the same instruction is given for doing the Lord's Supper as it is giving of your money.
Mm-hmm.
So do you encourage somebody?
Right. Right. You're pretty good at passing that plate around. Yeah. Right. If you don't have a plate, we'll just take the hat off the head and pass it around. We'll find a way to get that money.
But
sure.
One thing you can come back to is, well, we eat 3 meals a day, but is it common? When you start to get hungry, it's not common at all. You expect that, and that's what we're supposed to do.
I'm guessing, and that's a good question that you had, because what we begin to see, and we're going to get into this, with regards to baptism being administered a couple times out of the year, and I'm wondering if the Lord's Supper followed suit. You understand what I'm saying? If you're beginning to take something like baptism to say a couple times out of the year is good enough, why not include the Lord's Supper? Okay, why not just push that right in with it? Again, the target is always moving. When you begin to abandon, you know, the blueprint, the law, the word, you know, anything goes, guys. You get on that slippery slope, okay? Y'all don't know anything about slippery slopes at your house, do you? But when you get on that slippery slope, that's just, I digress. That's a whole other story, Don. But when you get on that slippery slope, man, I tell you, you know, and that's what I'm saying. Back, you know, I heard through my youthful years in the church, a movement that was taking place was change. We got to change. Okay. Well, what are we changing into? I don't know. Well, okay. Are you comfortable with just changing into anything? You know, well, we just got to change. You know, you got to be careful about that, church. Okay, I'm not saying that. You know, I'm all for scriptural changes, but I'm not for unscriptural changes. And the individuals that were clamoring for change, you know, were clamoring for change into worship. Well, you know, we can have instruments, and I'm good with that. You know, there's brethren today that I went to college with, grew up with, that, you know, they've changed so much, man, I don't even recognize them today. I just don't even recognize them today. Dale.
Well, the church probably look kind of down on you people. You know, you're weird because look at everybody else. They're doing this, and we like that. And if you're not doing anything, and you think you're the only ones that are right,
mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. But if that's what we're told to do, then we've got to do that, not what everybody else thinks we do. And then Christians became, you know, Big Church Christ became embarrassed because of that, and they wanted to be more like the other one so they wouldn't be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that movement came, and then all of a sudden, you know, you just put the foot down and say, no, we can't do that.
Dale, I'm going to tell you where the movement came from. It's when Jesus said that with regards to his disciples, they will not listen to the voice of strangers. We started listening to the voice of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start listening to the voice of strangers, you start practicing strange doctrine. And that's where that movement came from. No joke. Gone.
I want to make a comment about the Lord's Supper before we move on.
Yes.
A lot of folks in the church don't recognize the idea of closed communion versus open communion. Many groups, like many of the Baptist groups, have what they call closed communion. The deacons in many of the Baptist church, when they pass communion, even if they only do it three or four times a year, or Easter and Christmas or whatever, they take it to members. They don't offer it to anyone else. And that's called closed communion. We practice open communion. We pass it. It's up to the people who take it to make the decision about whether they're comfortable taking it. Mm-hmm. I know that we offer communion every week because of what we read in the scriptures. And we, but we offer open communion. And I found that many, particularly younger members of the church, don't even have an idea of what open versus closed communion is.
Yeah.
So that's why I wanted to bring it up now.
Right. Good point. Go ahead, Carl.
There's a young lady out at my nursing home. She won't partake of the Lord's Supper because her pastor told her not to. Mm-hmm. He would bring it to her, but he doesn't bring it to her. At least he has to bring it here every week. And so, but he said, I'll bring it to you next Sunday. And it'd been four Sundays ago. So
sure.
She will not partake of it because he told her not to.
Yeah, he's told her not to. Yeah.
You know, I've seen churches do that. You know, if they're not a member, then you just don't do things like that and kind of look down on them. If some stranger comes in and does it, and I've seen kids do it out of, you know, just wanting to do something else. But what is it hurting them if they do partake of it?
Mm-hmm.
They're already lost. Mm-hmm. Is it going to make them more lost?
Right.
So it's
right.
not our right. decision. We're to examine ourselves.
Right.
And if they do it, it's, you know, it's just somebody taking, you know, juice and a cracker going on. But the Christians, it means something else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We don't have the right to say you can and you can't.
And how do you, when you have visitors, how do you know?
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? That could be pretty offensive, you know?
I mean, drive them away.
Carl and Jana come up from Georgia and, you know, I mean, you would be half tempted to drink at least a little bit of that juice if he just got out of football practice, you know, and just like, man, I'm just parched, you know, and but, you know, so, yeah. That's a good point, Don, to bring that up. You know, and that brings up another good point with regards to, you know what I'm beginning to see? I hate to say this. With our younger folks, I am fearful there's a disconnect in what we're discussing right now with our younger folks. They again, like Don had mentioned, you know, open communion versus closed communion. And you sat down and you talked to your 20-year-old something child about that, and they're like, look at you like you got a third eyeball. What are you talking about? You know, things like that. That concerns me. You know, and that's why these classes are important and they are relevant. Okay. And when we say, man, our kids just don't know, well, ultimately we have that responsibility at home. Okay. Every home needs to be a church, folks. You know, we have that responsibility at home, but also to do that teaching, you know, as we assemble. Dale.
We worked with teams. I have actually heard the teams. Some of the teams tell their dates that come in. They're not members out there. Well, this is just for us. And when you become a Christian, then you can do this. Well, that's a turnoff in the beginning of itself. We don't have the right to do that. But it's just lack of teaching, you know. There's nothing wrong with them doing it. If they ask about it, then we can explain to it what it's for, who it's yeah. for, what it's about.
Yeah, you got to use some wisdom. Absolutely. Go ahead, Dan.
You have to teach as you go to now, because I don't. I mean, Carlin asked me when. I mean, he's 11 years old.
Yeah.
You know, hey, well, I want to partake of that, and I told him he could. After church was over, I explained to him why. But I'm not going to let an 11-year-old take communion.
Right.
You don't know what he's doing.
And that's it, Dan. That's a teachable moment. That's a teach. And I'm not saying you're wrong for that. You know, It gives you an opportunity to explain to him the purpose of the Lord's Supper, right? And the meaning of it, Austin.
You have to decide for yourself what side of this you want to come down on. Because on the one hand, you would want to honor the commandment to take the Lord's Supper in a worthy manner.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two ways that you could come down on that side. One, if the person that is taking the Lord's Supper is not yet a Christian and has not taken on Christ in the form of baptism, they are unable to partake in the Lord's Supper by design, in the same way that somebody who has not truly confessed that Jesus Christ is the Son of the Lord cannot be baptized. They haven't followed that correct order. So, if you fall on the conservative side, not letting them partake of it is a perfectly valid thing to do. On the other side of it, if you, and I'm not using liberal as a bad term here, but if you fall under the guise that they are physically unable to anyway, and they want, you know, some unleavened bread and grape juice, and they want to feel a part of that family, I feel like I don't see anything that explicitly says that you can't do that.
Mm.
And I think either way, you could use that as a teachable moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the operative word. It always must be a teachable moment, whether it's an 11-year-old or an 81-year-old. It still needs to be a teachable moment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Dale says. If you come down and tell somebody, hey, you can't do that because mm-hmm. that's for us, that's going to come down wrong, especially if you're not talking to them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And even so, like, that's a very conflict-rich environment.
I know. In some situations, let me say this, man, we're wading out into the water here, you know, but it can be apples and oranges in some situations. When you're talking about an 11-year-old, I'll throw this out here, you know, that I know of a family that allows their kids who knows absolutely nothing about the Lord's Supper to sit there and partake. And I'll just be honest, I got issues with that. I've got issues, I'll just tell you. And they just sat there and eat the cracker and drink the juice. And, you know, and brother, I'm here to tell you, when you study the Lord's Supper, there is a purpose for that Lord's Supper. Okay? It's not just juice and crackers at recess.
That would be an unworthy manner then.
Well, that's just what Harlan asked me if he could be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him when he learned more about why do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And he could. Go through and, you know, why do you want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if your reason to be baptized is, so I can take communion, that's not the reason to be baptized.
Right. Right.
So, I mean,
right. I haven't had a bath in 3 weeks, so,
started,
you know, I want to get wet. Right. No, teachable moments, you know, there's teaching that goes on there, you know, and you know, we you know, some of us, I know we have seen that before, you know, with not here, but I'm saying elsewhere, you know, where we've had this discussion, you know, where, you know, children are just little small children, you know, have no clue what it's about, no clue, and are just, you know, and they want more. It's like, you know, as Wes had said, you know, worthy, it's something that's critical. This is a serious, the Lord's Supper is a somber and serious time.
And if you allow them to do that when they're young,
right,
when are they going to learn what it's about?
Right. And then it just becomes more of a tradition. It's just nothing. Go ahead, Austin.
I have to respectfully disagree on this one. I think that...
Ask me if I'm surprised.
No, I don't. Well,
that's okay.
I was into both, okay? And yeah. I got to give credit where credit was due. This one's, like, Kat is the one that really changed my mind on this. And she came to me, because I saw this happen at our church, and I was like, I can't believe they're doing that.
Uh-huh.
And I said that to her, you know, in private.
Right.
And she was like, why does that bother you? Because is there anywhere in the Bible where it says specifically that they can't? And I couldn't come to a reason. The only thing that I could say is that you had to take the Lord's Supper in a worthy manner.
So are we going to baptize them?
The question is, if they're not baptized, they're not able to partake in the Lord's Supper because they're not in the Lord's
Body. My point is this. Follow my logic here, okay? If they don't understand what they're doing about the Lord's Supper, and they don't understand what they're doing about baptism, so we should baptize them when they don't understand it, right?
Absolutely not.
Okay, then why is it okay to go ahead and give them the Lord's Supper?
Because they're not partaking the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper and baptism are both symbolic. If you baptize somebody that doesn't understand...
There's not a purpose for it?
In the same way... So, Scott, you could take anybody off the street that knows nothing about nothing about the Lord Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Go take them to that baptism and put them under water. Did you baptize them?
I'm not doing that. I will never do that.
But
Austin, you're presenting an argument that you can't prove because I would never do that.
There are people that have done it, and they're not baptizing. When you look at other religions, that will do that as an introduction,
they are
getting wet. You would never call that a baptism. You have called it up front. You have said they are getting wet.
Uh-huh.
So that is not a baptism. So if they are eating juice and crackers as a welcoming to the family, I understand that's not the Lord's Supper. I'm not going to let them ruin that experience for me, because that's a respectful occasion.
So can I use your analogy with the children, okay? And I'm following you. I'm tracking you. So if a three-year-old, okay, let's go with the example that we used tonight, and they come forward and they want to be baptized. You're telling me on one hand, because they don't know what they're doing with the Lord's Supper, I'm supposed to serve that to them, and that's okay. But I can't baptize them because they don't know what they're doing. There's no consistency then.
I'm agreeing with him.
Well,
I think that the scripture to apply here is 1 Corinthians 11:28, that we must examine himself. And so we practice open communion because the folks who are, if we have visitors, we offer them.
Okay.
If they want to take it, it's up to them to examine themselves. It's not up to us to examine them.
Are you assuming some level of maturity, though, when you're reading that, Don?
Yes, I am.
A three-year-old?
Not a three-year-old.
Okay, so...
But I wouldn't give it to a three-year-old. I would stop a three-year-old from taking it.
But that's what I'm saying.
But now we're back to the point where you say it's the hype...
You have that ability to examine yourself.
You said it was hypothetical. About his question about your baptizing somebody, taking them and baptizing them without them knowing it, because you would never do that. I wouldn't ever give a three-year-old the crackers from the communion. So,
well, that's what I said.
We're in exactly the same place.
Right? He said that I would, you know, and essentially I would baptize someone who doesn't, and I would.
No, he didn't say you would. He was using it as an example of the symbolism involved.
If you are worried about what somebody is doing in the church, in the context of the Lord's Supper, because if somebody's taking the Lord's Supper, so are you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is affecting your heart and your ability to focus on the Lord during taking the Lord's Supper, you are doing more damage to yourself thinking about how wrong that is than they are doing by partaking of it themselves.
Okay. Anybody else got a comment? Dan.
I don't know whose camp this is in, but I'm saying, all right?
I'm sure you'll come out and be in your own camp all by yourself, Dan. But go ahead.
But I'm actually saying, come on, let their 3 or 4 year old child protect the community.
Uh-huh.
Me personally, okay, I didn't agree with it, but how do you approach a mother that's coming and hopefully learning about the church?
Right.
If that's not supposed to be that.
Right.
You know, because
just tell them.
You may drive her away from the church.
Right.
That's
I see your point.
Our objective.
Right.
Our objective is to teach her.
And that's why I said it's a teachable moment. Okay? Guys, I think we got way out there. We're in the daisy field. I keep getting back to the point, and even the passage you read, Dawn, assumes that there's a level of individual maturity. There is a
Examine himself.
A three-year-old. Guys, if that's what you think, it applies to a three-year-old, we might as well start baptizing.
I don't think.
Baptizing them.
Scott, that's you're way out in the daisy field. Nobody here has said we should baptize three-year-olds or that we should give them the Lord's Supper.
Right.
The question was whether we should prohibit little children who don't understand.
Right. And, no
and
one
Dale's
has,
Dale's comment was it's up to the parents to do that.
Right. No one has. I think where I was coming from was justification for doing it. That was my point. Justification for doing it. If you're going to justify one, why not justify the other? That's where I'm coming from. I'm not saying, we need to excommunicate you because you gave your 3-year-old communion. I keep saying the operative word is teachable moments. I think that you need to probably get with that sister and say, hey, look, do you understand? Does the child understand why they're doing that? You know, I would do the same thing if it were about baptism. That's why I keep coming back to it. Dale, you're waving your hand. Your hand's about ready to fall off.
Let's come back to common sense. You may lose that when it comes to religion sometimes. If I'm passing the communion, the Lord's Supper is an individual thing that we are to examine ourselves, not the person next to us. That person has an obligation to do that if he knows to do that even.
Right.
Now, when you get young children sitting in here, any young kid wants to do what somebody else is doing. So they will ask, you know, they'll try to take that.
Sure.
Where are the responsibility of the parent? Bring your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord.
Right.
That excludes training. And if that's the case, the parent should say no. If the parent doesn't know to do that, if you don't make a big fuss out of it and take it away from them, it's the year again you come back and the parents need to be taught and instructed on how to do that, what it's for, and that's the responsibility of the parents. Now, who should go to the parent? The leaders of the church should do that.
Here come the kids.
Now, as far as the baptism goes, we don't baptize 3 years old. Why? Because it's got common sense that they don't know what they're doing. The same thing with the Lord's Supper. They do not know what they're doing.
Excuse me, Dale. We've already said that. The kids are coming up. We need to end. We need to end the class.
And that's a wrap.
Now.
That's
way
it.
And that way. And don't know what it's about.
Next week, we're going to talk about asceticism and celibacy. Let's see what we can get into there.
Celibacy?
Did
you say celibacy?
Being celibate.